Recognizing the truth of Lincoln's words, Hay speculated that Chase would try to make capital out of this Rosecrans business, though Lincoln had simply relieved the general from command of the Department of the Tennessee at Grant's request. Lincoln drolly replied, "I suppose he will, like the bluebottle fly, lay his eggs in every rotten spot he can find." In late September, as the rift within Missouri's Republican Party threatened to erupt into open warfare, Chase continued his divisive plotting. Lincoln sought to keep radicals and conservatives united against the rebels. Chase aligned himself with the radicals. The struggle centered on Reconstruction. Since the Emancipation Proclamation did not extend to the loyal border states, the people of Missouri were left to determine the fate of slavery independently in their state. The conservatives, led by Frank Blair and Bates's brother-in-law, Governor Hamilton Gamble, were in favor of a gradual emancipation that provided protection to slaveholders during a transitional period. Radical leaders, such as B. Gratz Brown, Charles Drake, and Henry Blow, favored changes in the state constitution that would immediately extinguish slavery. So flammable had the dispute become that Governor Gamble worried the radicals intended to overthrow the elected state government. For their part, the radicals had come to believe that General John M. Schofield, the military commander of Missouri, whom Lincoln had put in place as a neutral figure, had become a conservative partisan. He was accused of abusing his authority by arresting leading radicals and suppressing radical papers under the guise of military necessity. On September 30th, a delegation of radicals led by Charles Drake journeyed to Washington to demand Schofield's removal. The night before the scheduled meeting, Lincoln talked with Hay about the tense situation. He acknowledged Hay's argument that the radicals would carry the state, and it would be well not to alienate them. Moreover, he believed that these radical men have in them the stuff which must save the state and on which we must mainly rely. They would never abandon the cause of emancipation. While the conservatives, in casting about for votes to carry through their plans, are tempted to affiliate with those whose record is not clear. "If he had to choose," Lincoln told his aide, "if one side must be crushed out and the other cherished, he would side with the radicals." On another occasion, he had expressed this affinity more strongly, stating that they are nearer to me than the other side, in thought and sentiment, though bitterly hostile personally. While they might be the unhandiest devils in the world to deal with, their faces are set Zionwards. Nevertheless, Lincoln refused to be coerced into choosing one faction or the other, and resented the radicals' demand that he treat Gamble, Frank Blair, and the conservatives as copperheads and enemies to the government, rather than as mere political opponents. "This is simply monstrous," Lincoln declared, "to denounce men who had courageously upheld the Union in the early days, when that affiliation threatened not only their political futures, but their very lives." By contrast, the delegation's vociferous leader, Charles Drake, was originally a Southern-leaning Democrat who had delighted in railing against black Republicans. Not that he objected to penitent rebels being radical. He was glad of it. But fair play. Let not the pot make injurious reference to the black base of the kettle. He was in favor of short statutes of limitations. Wells understood Lincoln's dilemma. "So intense and fierce were these radicals," he wrote in his diary, "that they might well inflict greater injury on those Republicans who do not conform to their extreme radical and fanatical views than on the rebels in the field." Such vindictiveness, he lamented, was among the saddest features of the times. Lincoln assured Hay that if the radicals could show that Schofield has done anything wrong, and has interfered to their disadvantage with state politics, he would consider their case. But if Schofield had incurred their ill will by refusing to take sides with them, then it would be an entirely different matter. Indeed, I cannot do anything contrary to my convictions to please these men, earnest and powerful as they may be. No sooner had the delegates settled themselves at the Willard Hotel than they received an invitation to spend the evening at Chase's home. When Bates learned of the invitation, he told Gamble he was surprised and mortified that Chase had extended his hand to those men he considered mortal enemies, and still more surprised when Chase invited him as well. He immediately declined. "I refuse flatly to hold social, friendly intercourse with men who daily denounce me and all my friends as traitors." Gamble replied that Bates should hardly be shocked by Chase's willingness to entertain these dogs, crossed out, persons, for Mr. Chase is the author of our troubles here. His criminal ambition for the presidency had led him to incite the struggle, and he would undoubtedly have the support of every radical paper in the state if he were to decide to run against Lincoln. The president's meeting with the Missourians lasted over 2 hours. Drake read his list of demands as pompously as if it were full of matter instead of wind, noted John Hay. Lincoln listened attentively, allowing his critics to enumerate their grievances. He knew well that these men would be important in the coming presidential canvass, but felt their call for Schofield's dismissal was misguided. He explained his position clearly, calmly, and forcefully, both at the meeting that day and in a letter drafted a few days later. While he acknowledged their version of the turmoil facing Missouri, he was not convinced that Schofield was responsible for that suffering and wrong. On the contrary, he suggested, all the troubles they described could be explained by the fact that during a civil war, confusion abounds. Deception breeds and thrives. Confidence dies, and universal suspicion reigns. Until he received evidence that Schofield had used his powers arbitrarily, for or against a particular faction, he could not, in good conscience, remove him from command. That evidence had not been provided. The president never appeared to better advantage in the world, Hay noted proudly in his diary, though he knows how immense is the danger to himself from the unreasoning anger of that committee. He never cringed to them for an instant. He stood where he thought he was right and crushed them with his candid logic. Lincoln emerged from the meeting in a good humor, Bates observed. Some of them, he said, were not as bad as he supposed. Yet, while clarifying the fact that whoever commands in Missouri or elsewhere was responsible to him and not to either radicals or conservatives, Lincoln once again moved to defuse the situation without alienating vital constituents. On the day the radicals left town, he wrote to remind Schofield that his authority to arrest individuals and suppress assemblies or newspapers was limited only to those who were working palpable injury to the military. Indeed, several months later, when Lincoln became convinced that Schofield was actually leaning toward the conservatives, instead of using his influence to harmonize the conflicting elements, he decided to replace him with Rosecrans, a man long favored by the radicals. But even then he engineered the transfer in a manner that protected Schofield's good name, while preserving his own presidential authority to determine when and where to change his commanders. At this juncture, Frank Blair seriously aggravated matters. That October, returning to Missouri after heroic duty with Grant and Sherman at Vicksburg, the soldier politician escalated the dissension with an explosive speech. before an overflowing crowd at Mercantile Library Hall in St. Louis, he proclaimed his firm opposition to every one of the radicals' Reconstruction ideas. Condemning their call for the immediate emancipation of Missouri's slaves, he insisted that no action should be taken until the war was won. He argued that Missourians should focus solely on supporting the Union, deferring all issues regarding slavery. He warned that if the radicals gained control, the country would degenerate into a revolution like that which afflicted France. They would set themselves up as judges, witnesses, and executioners alike. They would send to the guillotine men who come back grimed all over with powder from our battlefields, but who happen to disagree with them on Reconstruction. Blair then turned his ire on Chase, fully aware that the Treasury Secretary was hoping to ride the radical support to the White House. Loyalty to Lincoln and hatred for Chase combined to produce a vitriolic rant in which Blair accused the Secretary of manipulating Treasury regulations that governed the cotton trade between North and South to benefit his radical friends and prevent conservative merchants, who were among the first men to come forward and clothe and arm the troops, from receiving the cotton they desperately needed. As a friendly audience roared its approval, Blair accused Chase of using his cabinet post to create a political machine designed to unseat Lincoln in the next election. In sum, the Treasury Secretary was a traitor and blackguard, indistinguishable from Jefferson Davis himself. Blair's speech outraged the radicals, who promptly denounced him as a copperhead and a traitor. The Liberator criticized his vindictive language, observing that his style of address does him no honor and will not advance the ideas of public policy which he advocates. Even his sister Elizabeth remarked that he could not let even a great man set his small dogs on him without kicking the dog and giving his master some share of his resentment. Lincoln was dismayed by the whole affair, realizing that Frank, whom he liked a great deal, had seriously compromised his future. He wrote a letter to Monty, offering advice as if the tempestuous Frank were my brother instead of yours. He warned that by a misunderstanding, Frank was in danger of being permanently separated from those with whom only he can ever have a real sympathy, the sincere opponents of slavery. By allowing himself to be provoked into personal attacks, he could end up exiled from the house of his own building. He is young yet. He has abundant talent, quite enough to occupy all his time, without devoting any to temper. If Frank decided to resume his seat in the House when the new Congress assembled, he should bear this in mind. Otherwise, he would serve both the country and himself more profitably by returning to the military, where his recent promotion to Corps Commander proved that he was rising in military skill and usefulness. Lincoln's counsel to Frank was echoed in a gentle letter of reprimand to another young man whose intemperate words had made him vulnerable. Captain James Cutts, Jr., had been court-martialed for using unbecoming language in addressing a superior officer and for publicly derogating his superior's accomplishments to the point where a duel almost took place. Young Cutts was the brother of Adele Cutts, Stephen Douglas's second wife. In remitting the sentence, Lincoln wrote, "You have too much of life yet before you, and have shown too much of promise as an officer for your future to be lightly surrendered." He tried to impart some of the measured outlook that had served him so well. No man resolved to make the most of himself can spare time for personal contention. Still less can he afford to take all the consequences, including the vitiating of his temper and the loss of self-control. Yield larger things to which you can show no more than equal right, and yield lesser ones, though clearly your own. Better give your path to a dog than be bitten by him in contesting for the right. Even killing the dog would not cure the bite. Frank Blair's battle against Chase in Missouri was carried forward by Monty Blair in Maryland, where a similar struggle over Reconstruction had arisen. Chase again intervened, lending his support to the radical Henry Winter Davis as a candidate for Congress. Davis was a proponent of immediate, uncompensated emancipation and rigorous standards for defining eligibility to vote. Monty voiced his opposition at Rockville in early October, flaying the radicals' program and arguing that the ultra-abolitionists were as despotic as the old slavocrats. If they succeeded in their draconian measures toward the rebel states, he warned, it would be fatal to Republican institutions. He excoriated Sumner's proposition that the rebel states had forfeited their rights to equal participation in the Union by committing suicide by secession. Although Blair's speech met with approval from his partisan audience, it aroused deep hostility in Congress. 50 congressmen signed a petition calling on Lincoln to remove Blair from his cabinet. Once again, Lincoln was forced to balance the interests of contentious factions. Many assumed incorrectly that Blair was speaking for the White House. In fact, Lincoln refused to support Blair's candidate against Winter Davis, insisting that a Union convention had nominated Davis, and it would be mean to do anything against him. In the end, the president's most vital objective for Maryland was realized in the election, a dramatic Republican victory over the Copperheads, ensuring that the former slave state stood firmly behind the Union's cause. Noah Brooks attended a mass rally in Baltimore to celebrate the triumph of Winter Davis and the entire Republican ticket. As he surveyed the festive banners proclaiming "Slavery is dead," he marveled at the thought that not long before, the state was almost coaxed into open rebellion against the government in simulated defense of slavery. The enthusiastic crowd signaled that a great and momentous revolution had occurred in the hearts and minds of the people. "Do we dream," marveled Brooks, "or do we actually hear with our own ears loyal Marylanders making speeches in favor of immediate emancipation, and a loyal crowd of Baltimoreans applauding to echo the most radical utterances?" Chase was a featured speaker at the celebration, and according to Brooks, his simple words of sympathy and cheer for the struggling sons of freedom in Maryland were received with wildest enthusiasm. The complete triumph of the emancipationists was read as a sharp rebuke to Monty Blair and his fossil theories. Chase was elated, telling Greeley that he attached a great deal of importance to the occasion, for it suggested the time is ripe for a great unconditional Union party, with emancipation as a cardinal principle, a party with Salmon Chase, presumably, at its head. Worried that Lincoln's adversaries were successfully eclipsing him by appealing to the radical element, Leonard Swit recommended that the president call for a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery. "I told him if he took that stand, it was an outside position, and no one could maintain himself upon any measure more radical," Swett recalled. "And if he failed to take the position, his rivals would." Lincoln, too, could see the time coming for a constitutional amendment, and then whoever stands in its way will be run over by it. But the country was not yet ready. The discordant elements of the Great Coalition still had to be held together to ensure victory in the war. Moreover, he objected, "I have never done an official act with a view to promote my own personal aggrandizement, and I don't like to begin now." Herein, Swett concluded, lay the secret to Lincoln's gifted leadership. It was by ignoring men, and ignoring all small causes, but by closely calculating the tendencies of events and the great forces which were producing logical results. John Forney of the Washington Daily Chronicle observed the same intuitive judgment and timing, arguing that Lincoln was the most truly progressive man of the age, because he always moves in conjunction with propitious circumstances, not waiting to be dragged by the force of events, or wasting strength in premature struggles with them. Chapter 22. Still in Wild Water. As the fall 1863 elections in the crucial states of Ohio and Pennsylvania approached, Lincoln was visibly unsettled. Recalling the disastrous midterm elections of the previous autumn, he confided to Wells in October that his anxiety was greater than during his presidential race in 1860. If the anti-war Democrats had gained ground since the previous year, it would signal that Northern support for the war was crumbling. Such results would dispirit the army and invigorate rebel morale. While recent battlefield victories augured well for Republican chances, the divisive issues of civil liberties, slavery, and Reconstruction threatened to erode support in many places. Civil liberties was also a divisive issue in the Confederacy, which had suspended habeas corpus, imposed martial law, and instituted conscription. The former Confederate Secretary of State, Robert Toombs, accused that scoundrel Jeff Davis of pursuing an illegal and unconstitutional course that outraged justice and brought a tide of despotism upon the South. People in both North and South were becoming increasingly restive. Lincoln was particularly concerned about Ohio, where Democrats had chosen Copperhead Clement Vallandigham as their gubernatorial candidate against the pro-Union John Brough. Conducting his campaign from exile in Canada, Vallandigham was running on a platform condemning the war as a failure and calling for peace at any price, even if slavery was maintained and the Union divided. Lincoln was disheartened that the historic Democratic Party had selected a man such as Vallandigham for their representative man. Whatever votes he received would be a discredit to the country. In Pennsylvania, the Democrats were running George Woodward, an archly conservative judge, against Republican Governor Andrew Curtin. Though not as incendiary as Vallandigham's, Woodward's opinions were well known. Slavery, he had once said, was intended as a special blessing to the people of the United States. The contest tightened when the Woodward campaign received a welcome letter of support from George McClellan, written from his residence in New Jersey. If he were voting in Pennsylvania, McClellan wrote, he would give to Judge Woodward my voice and my vote. Lincoln, however, had learned from the bitter election of the previous year and took steps to ensure better results. Any government clerk from Ohio or Pennsylvania who wanted to go home to vote was given a 15-day leave and provided with a free railroad pass for the trip. Recognizing that the absence of the army vote had been devastating to Republicans in 1862, the president also arranged for soldiers in the field to receive furloughs to return home to vote. A week before the election, Chase called on Lincoln with a suggestion. If the president granted him a leave of absence from the Treasury, he, like his clerks, would go home to vote the Union ticket. Lincoln had no doubt that Chase would use the campaign trip to bolster his own drive for the presidency. Nevertheless, Chase's presence in Ohio might well help the Union ticket. To ensure publicity, Chase invited the journalist Whitelaw Reed to accompany him on the train to Columbus and write regular dispatches for the Cincinnati Gazette and the Associated Press as they traveled around the state. Advance word of the train's arrival was circulated, and an enormous crowd greeted Chase in Columbus at 2 a.m. The delighted secretary was met with prolonged cheering and shouts of hurrah for our old governor. How are you, old greenbacks? Glad to see you home again. Chase indicated his gratitude for this most unexpected welcome and proceeded to give a speech that ostensibly praised the president as a man who is honestly and earnestly doing his best, even though the war was not being prosecuted so fast as it ought. With a different leader, he hinted, some mistakes might have been avoided, some misfortunes averted. At each stop in his swing through Ohio, Chase encountered huge crowds of supporters. I come not to speak, but to vote, he insisted, before launching into a series of self-promoting speeches laced with subtle denigration of Lincoln. Military bands followed him through the streets, creating a festival-like atmosphere. In Cincinnati, a long procession and a military escort accompanied Chase, seated in a carriage drawn by 6 white horses, to the Burnett House, the site of Lincoln's unpleasant encounter with Stanton during the Reaper trial. From the balcony of the elegant hotel, he delivered a few words, followed by a lengthy address that evening before a packed audience at Mozart Hall. With slavery and Reconstruction as his themes, he once again covertly criticized the president. He acknowledged that the Emancipation Proclamation was the great feature of the war, without which we could not achieve success, but hastened to add that it would have been even more right had it been earlier and without exceptions. Lincoln had calculated correctly by giving Chase permission for the trip. His tour helped draw record numbers of pro-Union supporters to the polls. In public squares lit by bonfires and torchlights, the former governor called upon his fellow Ohioans to regard the election as the day of trial for our country. All eyes turn to Ohio. On the Monday before the voting, he begged his audiences to remember that tomorrow is the most important of all the 365 days in the year. On election day, Lincoln took up his usual post in the crowded telegraph office. By midnight, everything indicated good results in both Ohio and Pennsylvania. Still, the president refused to retire until he was certain. At 1:20 a.m., a welcome telegram arrived from Chase. The victory is complete, beyond all hopes. Chase predicted that Breaux's margin over Vallandigham would be at least 50,000. And would rise higher still when the soldiers' vote was counted. By 5 a.m., Breaux's margin had widened to 100,000. Glory to God in the highest, Lincoln wired to the victorious governor-elect. Ohio has saved the nation. The results from Pennsylvania, where Governor Curtin defeated his anti-war challenger, produced another jubilant outburst in the telegraph office. All honor to the Keystone State, Stanton wired to John Forney. In July, he wrote, the state drove rebel invaders from her soil, and now, in October, she has again rallied for the Union and overwhelmed the foe at the ballot box. When Wells called on the president to congratulate him, he found him in good spirits. Republicans had crushed Copperheads in the 2 bellwether states, boding well for the congressional elections the following month. Chase had been instrumental in achieving these signal victories. If his journey home to Ohio had also advanced the secretary's presidential aspirations, so be it. Lincoln understood Chase's thirst for the presidency. No man knows what that gnawing is till he has had it, he said. Should Chase become president, he told Hay. All right. I hope we may never have a worse man. Lincoln might shut his eyes to Chase's stratagems so long as Chase remained a good secretary. But members of his cabinet possessed less tolerance. I'm afraid Mr. Chase's head is turned by his eagerness in pursuit of the presidency, Bates recorded in his diary. That visit to the West is generally understood as his opening campaign. Perusing newspaper accounts of Chase's speeches, the Attorney General noted derisively that his colleague had attributed the salvation of the country to his own admirable financial system, much as Cicero had sworn, "By the immortal gods, I have saved my country." Chase ought to have focused solely on his cabinet position, Bates observed, but it is of the nature of ambition to grow prurient and run off with its victim. Like Bates, Wells believed that Chase's presidential aspirations had warped his judgment, leading him to divisively exploit the Reconstruction issue to consolidate the radical wing of the party behind him. Yet these critiques were moderate compared to the scathing indictments the Blairs poured forth in daily correspondence to their friends. Chase remained oblivious to the ire of his colleagues. He had found the trip immensely gratifying. "I little imagined the reception that awaited me," he proudly told a friend. "Such appreciation and such manifestation of warm personal esteem move me deeply." Chase apparently never considered that he owed a good part of his tremendous reception to the president he represented and to the victories of the Union armies at Gettysburg and Vicksburg. All personal praise and flattering letters he accepted as his just due. "The late election in this city and state, to you more than to any other living man, was a personal triumph," he was told by James Baker, stationed in St. Louis. "I feel hopeful now for you in the contest of 64. After a few more fawning remarks, Baker proceeded to request a job as a collector, explaining that months in the saddle had produced a bad case of hemorrhoids, leaving him unfit for active duty. Chase also basked in the extravagant praise from the radical press. "To him, more than any other man in the cabinet," the Liberator wrote, "are we indebted for the president's proclamation and the other executive acts which have struck the diabolical system of slavery." The Liberator supposed Chase's victory over Seward's influence had finally allowed the proclamation to be issued. "If in any one month of Mr. Seward's administration he had chosen strenuously to urge upon Abraham Lincoln the abolition of slavery throughout the country, on the ground that the conflict is irrepressible," the Liberator maintained, "then the war would have ended in our victory within 6 months thereafter." The public should carefully consider whether a vote for old Abe will not choose Seward to be, again, acting president. No one understood better than Seward the absurdity of the claim that he was the acting president. By the fall of 1863, he had both accepted and respected Lincoln's consummate control of his cabinet, and the relationship between the two men had grown very close and unreserved, Fred Seward observed. Thrown into daily companionship, they found not only cordial accord in most of their political opinions, but a trait in common not shared by all their contemporaries. That was their disposition to take a genial philosophical view of human nature and of national destiny. Such intimate cooperation benefited not only both men, but the country at large. "As they sat together by the fireside, or in the carriage," Seward's son continued, "the conversation between them, however it began, always drifted back into the same channel, the progress of the great national struggle. Both loved humor, and however trite the theme, Lincoln always found some quaint illustration from his Western life, and Seward some case in point in his long public career that gave it new light." Fred Seward recounted the events of one morning in October 1863 when his father called on Lincoln. "They say, Mr. President, that we are stealing away the rights of the states," So I have come today to advise you that there is another state right I think we ought to steal." Raising his head from his pile of papers, Lincoln asked, "Well, Governor, what do you want to steal now?" Seward replied, "The right to name Thanksgiving Day." He explained that at present Thanksgiving was celebrated on different days at the discretion of each state's governor. Why not make it a national holiday? Lincoln immediately responded that he supposed a president had as good a right to thank God as a governor. Seward then presented Lincoln with a proclamation that invited citizens in every part of the United States, at sea or abroad, to set apart and observe the last Thursday of November to give thanks to our beneficent Father. The proclamation also commended to God's care all those who have become widows, orphans, mourners, or sufferers, and called on him to heal the wounds of the nation and restore it to peace, harmony, tranquility, and union. These sentiments would reappear in Lincoln's second inaugural, where once again, as with Seward's mystic chords in his first inaugural address, Lincoln would transform Seward's language into a powerfully resonant poetry. Their mutual faith in each other helped sustain both Lincoln and Seward through the continuing attacks of radicals and conservatives. Under political fire, both men remained remarkably calm. Lincoln told Nicolay that before his meeting with the Missouri radicals, Seward had asked him to prepare his response without saying a word to him on the subject, lest anyone claim he had influenced the president on the controversial matter. "Despite their precautions," said Lincoln, "Wendell Phillips gave a passionate speech decrying the White House response and stating that Seward had written the whole of that letter." As the November congressional elections approached, both men hoped that the North would overwhelmingly support the administration, the Union, and the war. They knew that these elections would set the stage for the presidential contest the following year. In one of their fireside conversations, Seward assured Lincoln that his own hopes for the presidency were all past and ended. He desired only that Lincoln be his own successor, for when the rebels find the people reaffirming their decision to have you president, I think the rebellion will collapse. 2 days before the November 3rd elections, Seward left for Auburn. He had worried for weeks about the condition of his son, Will, who had returned home on convalescent leave after contracting typhoid in the army. Will suffered fever and terrible stomach pains. As the illness progressed, he had to be carried from his bed to a chair where he could sit up for only short periods of time. The elections offered Seward a chance to attend to his son and rally support among New York voters as well. Lincoln, too, was concerned about young Will, whom he had come to like and respect. The previous spring he had ordered Will, then stationed with the Army in Virginia, to report to the White House for a special assignment. As Will later recalled, the road to the Capitol was exceedingly muddy that day. He appeared at the president's door, covered with mud, and looking more like a tramp than a soldier. He was well known to the old porter at the door, however, and was quickly ushered into the president's library. Lincoln greeted him warmly, handing him a secret dispatch for delivery to General Banks in Louisiana. He would have to travel through hostile areas, Lincoln warned, so he would have to take the chances of riding alone. The dispatch was of great importance and must not fall into the enemy's hands, so he should commit it to memory. Will left that night and delivered his intelligence safely. Seward arrived at home to find Will in stable condition. On election eve, he delivered a speech to the citizens of Auburn. He began with the sanguine prediction that the rebellion will perish, and slavery will perish with it. While his optimism might provoke criticism in some quarters, he explained, "As in religion, so in politics, it is faith and not despondency that overcomes mountains and scales the heavens." His faith, he predicted, would be confirmed by the Unionist triumph in the coming elections. The object of this election, he said, is the object of the war. It is to make Abraham Lincoln president de facto in the South, as he is in the North. There can be no peace and quiet until Abraham Lincoln is president of the whole United States. Then, arousing the wrath of radicals, Seward extended his hand to the South, saying, "I am willing that the prodigal son shall return. The doors, as far as I am concerned, shall always be open to him." As the voters went to the polls on Tuesday, Lincoln telegraphed Seward, "How is your son?" he inquired. "Thanks, William is better," Seward replied. "Our friends reckon on 25,000 majority in the state." New York did even better than that, reversing the losses of the previous year to give a 30,000 majority to the administration. "In every state, with the exception of New Jersey," Seward reported, "the Copperhead spirit is crushed and humbled." A festive atmosphere enveloped the nation's capital after the elections, as official Washington prepared for the social event of the decade, the wedding of Kate Chase and William Sprague. 50 guests, including the president, the entire cabinet, and selected congressmen, senators, and generals, were invited to the wedding ceremony on Thursday evening, November 12th, in the parlor of the Chase Mansion. 500 additional invitations had been delivered for the reception immediately following the exchange of vows. For weeks, the newspapers were filled with gossip about the wedding. It was said that Sprague had given Kate a diamond tiara worth $50,000. Women readers relished details about the bridal trousseau, the robes, the pearls, the diamonds, the lace, the silver, and all the magnificent gifts of this millionaire wedding. Curiosity seekers noted the arrival of eminent guests at the Willard Hotel. The spectacle offered a brief respite from the endless sorrows of the war, the casualty reports, the scenes of suffering in the hospitals, the rumors of impending military engagements. For Salmon Chase, the imminent marriage brought a welter of conflicting emotions. Writing frankly to Sprague, 13 days before the wedding, he acknowledged that he was beginning to realize how changed everything will be when she is gone. His life had long been occupied with the solicitous care of his beloved daughter, who had constantly become more thoughtful, more affectionate, more loving, and at this hour is dearer than ever. Though they would share the same Washington household, Chase understood that he would no longer enjoy Kate's undivided attention. By return mail, Sprague reassured Chase that he fully appreciated their high and holy relation and would never be happier than when contributing to continue the same relations between father and daughter that has heretofore existed. Referring most likely to his drinking problem, Sprague admitted that in the past he had neglected both mind and body, but promised henceforth to take care of himself and, with good health and a proper exercise of the talent God has been pleased to give me, I hope to do something useful for my day and generation. Those close to Kate remarked that her emotions ran high as the marriage drew near. John Hay recounted that she cried like a baby just weeks before the wedding when he took her to see Maggie Mitchell in The Pearl of Savoy. The play revolves around the romantic travails of Marie, a peasant girl whose innocent love for a peasant boy is thwarted by a lecherous aristocrat determined to possess the lovely young girl. Through the wealthy suitor's machinations, Marie's family stand to lose their farm unless she gives herself to him. Torn between her devotion to her noble father and her love for the young peasant boy, Marie goes mad. Perhaps Kate shed so many tears over the melodrama because she identified with the tormented heroine's devotion to her father. Over the years, as the Cinderella match would culminate in tragedy and poverty for Kate, journalists and historians have subjected Kate's feelings for Sprague to considerable analysis. Many have speculated that her decision to marry was a coldly calculated plan to secure the Sprague millions, thereby to advance the two great passions in her life, her father and politics. It was said that, in her eyes, all other men sank into insignificance when compared with her father, and that no one else had even the remotest hold upon her affections. Her marriage to Sprague would relieve her father from further financial worries and provide abundant means for an all-out presidential campaign in 1864. Even journalists at the time noted that outside of his fortune, Sprague possessed few attractive qualities. Having left school early for the cotton mill, he was wholly innocent of even an approximate understanding of the arts or sciences, polite or vulgar literature. Furthermore, he was small, thin, and unprepossessing in appearance. Still, if he was not physically attractive, the Brooklyn Daily Eagle noted, pecuniarily he is several millions. And as Gideon Wells recorded in his diary, Miss Kate has talents and ambition sufficient for both. Henry Adams was among those who deemed Kate's marriage a sacrifice for her father. He spoke of her as Jephthah's daughter, referring to the biblical warrior who promised God that if he gained success in battle, whatsoever greeted him at his victorious return would be sacrificed as a burnt offering. Jephthah arrived home triumphant and was greeted at his door by his daughter, his only child. As the anguished father prepared the sacrificial pyre, his daughter comforted him with assurances that she accepted her fate, for a promise made to God could not be broken. The sacrificial nature of this scenario is belied by Kate's own words, later confided to her diary as the fifth anniversary of her wedding approached. Thinking back to the night before her marriage, she wrote, "Memory has been busy with the hopes and dreams on a calm moonlight night 5 years ago of a woman, then in the full flush of social influence and triumph, whose career had been curiously independent and successful, surrounded by some kind friends, and many more ready to flatter and do her homage, accustomed to command and be obeyed, to wish and be anticipated, successful beyond any right or desert of her own to claim, and yet stood ready, without a sigh of regret, to lay all these and more upon the altar of her love, in exchange for a more earnest and truer life, one long dream of happiness and love." She remembered spending that evening praying that she might fill her role of loving wife to completeness, that she might become his companion, friend, and advocate, that he might be, in a word, a husband satisfied. All there is of love and beauty, nobleness and gentleness, were woven with this fair dream, and I believed no future brighter than that our united lives spread open before us. When folded in William's loving arms, she continued, "Oh, the sense of ineffable rest, joy, and completeness!" She felt like a child in security and trust, a lover won, a protector found, a husband to be cherished, not a reserve in my heart, not a hidden corner he might not scan, the first, the only man that had found a lodgment there. In the hours before the nuptials began, a large crowd of all sexes, ages, and conditions gathered around the Chase mansion to watch the procession of guests. The eager crowd was very good-natured, the Washington Daily Chronicle reported, exchanging congenial remarks as the occupants of the long line of carriages stepped down and proceeded inside. One by one the cabinet secretaries arrived, all but Monty Blair, who refused to attend, though his 80-year-old father thoroughly enjoyed himself and was quite the belle of the occasion. The entrance of Lord Lyons and the French minister, Count Henri Mercier, attracted attention, as did the arrivals of Generals Halleck, McDowell, and Robert C. Schenck. "Much anxiety was manifested for the appearance of President Lincoln," the Chronicle reported. At 8:30 p.m., minutes before the ceremony was scheduled to start, Lincoln pulled up in his carriage, unescorted, and without Mrs. Lincoln by his side. As Mary later said, she refused to bow in reverence to the twin gods, Chase and Daughter. Predictably, Mary's absence at the wedding was noticed by the press. Noah Brooks later reported that Lincoln stayed 2.5 hours to take the cuss off the meagerness of the presidential party. All eyes were on Kate, however, as she descended the staircase in a gorgeous white velvet dress with an extended train, and upon her head wore a rich lace veil encircled by her new pearl and diamond tiara. As the wedding party approached the Episcopal Bishop of Rhode Island, the Marine Band played a march composed specifically for the occasion. When the vows were completed, Chase was the first to kiss the newly made wife. A lavish meal was served, followed by dancing in the dining room, which lasted until midnight. John Hay thought it a very brilliant affair, noting that Kate had lost all her old severity and formal stiffness of manner, and seemed to think she had arrived. The young couple left the next morning for New York, where their presence at the Fifth Avenue Hotel drew crowds of women eager to see the young bride in person, having followed all the details of her wedding in the papers. Marriage did not diminish the regular flow of letters between father and daughter. "Your letter, so full of sweet words and good thoughts, came yesterday," Chase wrote Kate less than a week after the wedding, "and I need not tell you how welcome it was." His new son-in-law, to Chase's delight, also proved to be a good correspondent. "My heart is full of love for you both," Chase replied to Sprague, "and I rejoice, as I never expected to rejoice, in the prospects of happiness opening before both of you. I feared some inequalities of temper, some too great love of the world, either of its possessions or its shows, something I hardly know about. But I find that you each trust the other fully, and above all, that you both look to God for his blessing and guidance." Chase expressed but a single qualm. "I fear that Katie may be a little too anxious about my political future. She must not be so." He insisted to Sprague that nothing could be so uncertain as the political future of any man, and especially as the future which must be determined by popular preferences, founded quite as much on sentiment as on reason. While he suggested to his new son-in-law that the country needed a leader other than Lincoln, Chase ingenuously asserted that he would never allow himself to be drawn into any hostile or unfriendly position as to Mr. Lincoln. "His course towards me has always been so fair and kind. His progress towards entire agreement with me on the great question of slavery has been so constant, though rather slower than I wished for, and his general character is so marked by traits which command respect and affection, that I can never consent to anything which he himself could or should consider as incompatible with perfect honor and good faith." At a Tuesday cabinet meeting, shortly after Kate's wedding, Lincoln informed his colleagues that he would leave for Gettysburg that Thursday, November 19, 1863. He had been asked to say a few words to consecrate the cemetery grounds set aside so that the Union soldiers who had been interred near the battlefield and hospitals the previous July could be properly buried. Edward Everett, the noted orator and former president of Harvard, was scheduled to give the main address, after which the president would speak. Lincoln told his cabinet that he hoped they would accompany him to the dedication. Seward, Blair, and John Usher readily agreed, but the other members feared they could not spare the time from their duties, particularly since their annual reports to Congress were due in a couple of weeks. Lincoln was uneasy about the trip. He had been extremely busy, he told Ward Lemon, and had not been able to carve out the solitary time he needed to compose his address. He greatly feared he would not be able to acquit himself with credit, much less to fill the measure of public expectation. Stanton had arranged a special train for the presidential party to depart on the morning of the dedication and return home around midnight that same day. Lincoln, however, rescheduled it to leave on Wednesday. "I do not wish to so go that by the slightest accident we fail entirely," he explained, "and at the best, the whole to be a mere breathless running of the gauntlet." Perhaps he also hoped that an early departure from the White House would allow him more time to work on his address. The day before setting out, Lincoln told a friend he had found time to write about half of his speech. Various accounts suggest that he labored over the speech during the four-hour trip. One young man, peering through the window when the train was temporarily stopped at Hanover Junction, distinctly recalled the president at work on some document, the top of his high hat serving as a makeshift desk. Others swear that he jotted notes on an envelope as the train roared along. Nicolay, who was there, insists that he wrote nothing during the trip, choosing instead to relax and engage his fellow riders with good conversation and humorous stories. When Lincoln arrived at Gettysburg, he was escorted to the home of David Wills, the event organizer, where he would spend the night, along with Governor Andrew Curtin and Edward Everett. "All the hotels, as well as the private houses, were filled to overflowing," the New York Times reported. "People from all parts of the country seem to have taken this opportunity to pay a visit to the battlefields, which are hereafter to make the name of Gettysburg immortal." After supper, while Lincoln settled himself in his room to complete his draft, a crowd gathered in front of the house to serenade him. He came to the door to thank them, but said he would make no remarks for the simple reason that, "I have no speech to make. In my position, it is somewhat important that I should not say any foolish things." His reluctance elicited the snide comment from a member of the audience, "If you can help it." Lincoln's swift rejoinder delighted the crowd. "It very often happens that the only way to help it is to say nothing at all." Returning to his room, Lincoln sent a servant downstairs to fetch a few additional sheets of paper. A telegram arrived from Stanton with welcome news. Tad had been ill when Lincoln left that morning. The boy's condition had frightened Mary, but now the report that Tad was better eased Lincoln's mind, allowing him to focus on his speech. He went over each line, revising the ending, which was not yet satisfactory. Meanwhile, the crowd surged over to Robert Harper's house on the public square, where Seward was staying. Seward responded to the serenade with a heartfelt speech, concluding with thanks to the Almighty for the hope that this is the last fratricidal war which will fall upon this country, the richest, the broadest, the most beautiful, and capable of a great destiny that has ever been given to any part of the human race. Afterward, inside the house, the convivial secretary held sway for hours in such a lucid manner that Benjamin French, a fellow boarder, averred he had seldom, if ever, met with a man whose mind is under such perfect discipline and is so full of original and striking matter as Secretary Seward's. His conversation, no matter on what subject, is worthy of being written down and preserved, and if he had a Boswell to write, as Boswell did of Johnson, one of the most interesting and useful books of the age might be produced from the conversations and sayings of William H. Seward. He is one of the greatest men of this generation. Sometime after 11 p.m., Lincoln came downstairs, the pages of his speech in his hands. He wanted to talk with Seward, perhaps to share his draft with the colleague whose judgment he most respected and trusted. He walked over to the Harper house and remained there with Seward for about an hour before returning to his room and retiring. The huge, boisterous crowd on the public square, however, did not retire so easily. "They sang and hallooed and cheered," French recalled. Listening from his window, he heard a full chorus of the popular refrain, "We are coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more." After breakfast the next morning, Lincoln made his final revisions, carefully folded the speech, and placed it in his coat pocket. Mounting a chestnut horse, he joined the procession to the cemetery. He was accompanied by 9 governors, members of Congress, foreign ministers, military officials, and the 3 cabinet officers. Marine Lieutenant Henry Clay Cochran recalled that Seward, riding to Lincoln's right, was entirely unconscious that his trousers had pulled up above his shoes, revealing homemade gray socks, unbefitting the occasion. An audience of roughly 9,000 stretched away from the platform in a half circle. Lincoln was seated in the front row between Everett and Seward. For 2 hours, Everett delivered his memorized address, superbly recounting the various battles that had taken place over the 3 dramatic days. Lincoln reportedly leaned from one side to the other and crossed his legs, turning his eyes full upon the speaker. Somewhat later, he again shifted his position and rested his chin in the palm of his right hand. Another member of the audience remembered Lincoln removing his speech and glancing over it before returning it to his pocket. French lauded Everett's speech, believing it could not be surpassed by mortal man. Several correspondents were less enthusiastic. "Seldom has a man talked so long and said so little," wrote the editor of the Philadelphia Age. "He gave us plenty of words, but no heart. He talked like a historian, or an encyclopedist, or an essayist, but not like an orator." As Everett started back to his seat, Lincoln stood to clasp his hand and warmly congratulate him. George Gitt, a 15-year-old who had stationed himself beneath the speaker's stand, later remembered that the flutter and motion of the crowd ceased the moment the president was on his feet. Such was the quiet that his footfalls, I remember very distinctly, woke echoes, and with the creaking of the boards, it was as if someone were walking through the hallways of an empty house. Lincoln put on his steel-rimmed spectacles and glanced down at his pages. Though he had had but a brief time to prepare the address, he had devoted intense thought to his chosen theme for nearly a decade. As Gary Wills observes in his classic study of the address, he had spent a good part of the 1850s repeatedly relating all the most sensitive issues of the day to the Declaration's supreme principle. During the debates with Stephen Douglas, Lincoln had frequently reminded his audiences of the far-reaching promises contained in the Declaration of Independence. "Some day," he said, "all this quibbling about this race and that race and the other race being inferior would be eliminated, giving truth to the phrase, 'All men are created equal.'" 20 months before the Emancipation Proclamation, the president had told Hay that "the central idea pervading this struggle is the necessity that is upon us of proving that popular government is not an absurdity," predicting that "if we fail, it will go far to prove the incapability of the people to govern themselves." Now, tens of thousands had died in pursuit of that purpose. At Gettysburg, he would express that same conviction in far more concise and eloquent terms. 67 years ago, he began, "our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But, in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, nor long remember, what we say here. But it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they here gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. When Lincoln finished, the assemblage stood motionless and silent, according to the awestruck George Gitt. The extreme brevity of the address, together with its abrupt close, had so astonished the hearers that they stood transfixed. Had not Lincoln turned and moved toward his chair, the audience would very likely have remained voiceless for several moments more. Finally, there came applause. Lincoln may have initially interpreted the audience's surprise as disapproval. As soon as he finished, he turned toward Lemon. "Lemon, that speech won't scour. It is a flat failure, and the people are disappointed." Edward Everett knew better, and expressed his wonder and respect the following day. "I should be glad," he wrote Lincoln, "if I could flatter myself that I came as near to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes." Lincoln had translated the story of his country and the meaning of the war into words and ideas accessible to every American. The child who would sleeplessly rework his father's yarns into tales comprehensible to any boy had forged for his country an ideal of its past, present, and future that would be recited and memorized by students forever. Lincoln returned from Gettysburg to find a vexing letter from Zechariah Chandler, the radical Michigan senator who had made a fortune in dry goods and real estate before entering politics. Chandler had been a thorn in Lincoln's side, constantly criticizing his conduct of the war, his reliance on overly cautious conservative generals, and his tardiness on emancipation. "Your president is unstable as water," Chandler had warned Trumbull the previous September. "For God and country's sake, send someone to stay with him who will control and hold him." Now, without having seen a word of the president's upcoming message to Congress, which Lincoln had only begun drafting, Chandler was anticipating a disaster. Having read in the press that Thurlow Weed and New York Governor Edwin Morgan had come to the White House to urge a bold conservative stance in the message, Chandler warned the president that if he acquiesced, he would jeopardize all the gains made in the fall elections. The president must realize that in each of the victorious states, radical platforms had carried the day. He could be the master of the situation, Chandler patronizingly suggested, only if he could stand firm against the influences of men like Weed, Seward, and Blair. "They are a millstone about your neck." If he dropped them, They are politically ended forever. The success of the radical canvass proved that. Conservatives and traitors are buried together. For God's sake, don't exhume their remains in your message. They will smell worse than Lazarus did after he had been buried 3 days. Ordinarily, Lincoln would have shelved Chandler's arrogant letter until his temper cooled. This time, however, he did not stifle his anger. Apparently, Chandler had struck a nerve by insinuating that Lincoln did not know his own mind. Although the president listened to the opinions of many, he took pride in arriving at his own decisions in his own way. Nor would he countenance Chandler's slanderous assertion that men like Seward, Weed, and Blair deserved the dishonorable grave of traitors. "My dear sir," Lincoln began his cold reply, "I have seen Governor Edwin D. Morgan and Thurlow Weed separately, but not together, within the last 10 days. But neither of them mentioned the forthcoming message, or said anything so far as I can remember, which brought the thought of the message to my mind. I am very glad the elections this autumn have gone favorably, and that I have not, by native depravity, or under evil influences, done anything bad enough to prevent the good result. I hope to stand firm enough not to go backward, and yet not go forward fast enough to wreck the country's cause." Lincoln's impatience with Chandler may have been aggravated by the fact that he was coming down with a mild case of smallpox. The illness would last for several weeks and fray his self-restraint, yet it left his humor intact. "Yes, it is a bad disease, but it has its advantages," he told some visitors. "For the first time since I have been in office, I have something now to give to everybody that calls." The enforced bed rest that attended his sickness allowed Lincoln the quiet he needed to complete his message to Congress. The pause in his frenetic life proved helpful as he laid out his own views on the knotty problem of Reconstruction, which he considered the greatest question ever presented to practical statesmanship. Most everyone assumed, Noah Brooks wrote, that the president would either ignore Reconstruction altogether, as the conservatives suggested, or follow the radicals' advice and give an elaborate and decisive program. No one predicted such an original message, which cleverly mollified both wings of his divided party. John Hay was present when the message was read. "I never have seen such an effect produced by a public document," he recorded in his diary that night. Chandler was delighted, Sumner was beaming, while at the other political poll, James Dixon and Reverdy Johnson said it was highly satisfactory. Radicals were thrilled with the stipulation that, before the president would pardon any rebel or restore the rights of property, he must not only swear allegiance to the Union, but also accept emancipation. To abandon the laws and proclamations promising freedom to the slaves would be a cruel and an astounding breach of faith, Lincoln said, adding that, "While I remain in my present position, I shall not attempt to retract or modify the Emancipation Proclamation, nor shall I return to slavery any person who is free by the terms of that proclamation or by any of the acts of Congress." By this statement, Sumner enthused, he makes emancipation the cornerstone of Reconstruction. The Missouri radical Henry Blow agreed. Though he recently had castigated Lincoln, he now lauded him. "God bless old Abe," he said. "I am one of the radicals who have always believed in the president." Once again, the radicals' doubts about Lincoln's firmness on slavery had proved unfounded. Early in August, he had written a letter to Nathaniel Banks, the general in charge of occupied Louisiana, delineating his thoughts on Reconstruction and emancipation. While not desiring to dictate to the Creole state, Lincoln would be glad for her to make a new constitution, recognizing the Emancipation Proclamation and adopting emancipation in those parts of the state to which the proclamation does not apply. And while she is at it, I think it would not be objectionable for her to adopt some practical system by which the two races could gradually live themselves out of their old relation to each other, and both come out better prepared for the new. Education for young blacks should be included in the plan. Agreeing that no rebellious state could be reconstructed without emancipation, Lincoln still refused to tolerate the radicals' desire to punish the South. He offered full pardons to all those who took the oath, excepting those who had served at high levels in the Confederate government or the army. When the number of loyal men taking the oath reached 10% of the votes cast in the 1860 election, they could reestablish a state government recognized by the United States. The names and boundaries of the states would remain as they were. Conservatives hailed the 10% plan, believing it effectively destroyed Sumner's scheme to consider the defeated states as territories that Congress could rename and reorganize as it wished. Nevertheless, Sumner told a fellow radical that Lincoln's theory is identical with ours, for he too required reconstruction before the subverted rebel states could rejoin the Union, although he adopts a different nomenclature. In presenting his 10% plan, Lincoln assured members of Congress that it was not fixed in stone. He would listen to their ideas as the process evolved. He hoped simply to give the southern states a rallying point, bringing them to act sooner than they otherwise would. He recognized that it would devastate Confederate morale to see Southern citizens declare their fealty to the Union and their support for emancipation. Though the Heppy Accord would not last long, Lincoln had succeeded for the moment in uniting the Republican Party. When the Blairs, Sumner, and the Missouri Radicals are alike agreed to accept the president's message, Brooks observed, we may well conclude that the political millennium has well nigh come, or that the author of the message is one of the most sagacious men of modern times. The president, announced Congressman Francis Kellogg of Michigan, is the great man of the century. There is none like him in the world. He sees more widely and more clearly than anybody. Lincoln's old friend, Norman Judd, called on the president the evening of the annual address. He speculated that, given the radical tone of the document, Blair and Bates must walk the plank. On the contrary, Lincoln assured him, both acquiesced in it without objection. The only member of the cabinet who objected to it was Mr. Chase. Chase had obstinately